Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maines, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Rich Strolis, and he'll be answering your most important questions on catching shadows. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Rich a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your questions immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Rich Strolis about catching shadows. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida and the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Rich, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we're going to give away tonight on our drawing. Tonight we're going to give away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Rich's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Rich's latest book, Catching Shadows, courtesy of Headwater Books. Now, here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something that Rich and I talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and hopefully you'll be the proud owner of Rich's book, Catching Shadows. Our guest tonight is Rich Strolis. Rich started as a guide on the ever-popular Farmington and Housatonic Rivers in Connecticut. He later transitioned his work to commercial tying, speaking engagements, and teaching many facets of both fly fishing and fly tying across the Northeast and Eastern Seaboard. His fly patterns, although based out of the Northeast, have a strong following and relevance across the globe and have been tied and finished by many as a result of his library of online videos. He's a signature fly designer for Montana Fly Company, which currently produces 22 of his patterns. His patterns have appeared in several national magazines and books, including Fly Fisherman, Eastern Fly Fishing, Strip Set, Fusion Tying, Caddis Flies, and 50 Best Places, Fly Fishing, the Northeast, and many more. Rich is a very well-rounded trout fisherman, but his passion lies in chasing trophy trout and various other apex predators on streamers. His highly anticipated first book, Catching Shadows, Tying Flies for the Toughest Fish and Strategies for Fishing Them from Headwater Books, was published in January of 2016. Rich plans on getting back out there guiding full-time in the not-so-distant future. Rich, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for having me once again.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. And beautiful book you put together there, and sounds like it's, from what you've said before we started the show, it's becoming a great success.
Yeah, it's doing really, really well. I've been just kind of inundated with nothing but positive feedback, so it really kind of makes you feel good about all the hard work that you put into a project like that. So it's going pretty cool. So it's a good time. I'm kind of just soaking it all in as we speak.
Yeah, well, good job. Excellent. And we'll get to talk about at least part of it tonight. There's so much there that we'll just make a small dent in it. But hopefully it'll get some of the listeners excited about getting a copy of their own so that they can try out some of these great patterns that you've got in there. Well, let's see. To get started here, and we've got a bunch to cover, first thing is, I guess I have to ask you, you know, and I ask many of the authors this, is why'd you write Catching Shadows?
You know, to be honest with you, it's kind of a labor of love. I never anticipated on writing a book at this stage in my life. I knew that it was something that I wanted to do. I just never thought that it would happen now, but you got to kind of strike when the iron's hot. I was definitely prodded by several other people in the fly fishing industry, you could still say, so to speak. They kind of pushed me into it. The last two or three years since we last spoke on streamers, I've had a lot of my flies in several other publications. I know George Daniel, you recently had on. I had a bunch of my streamers in his book, and that was kind of some good publicity there. He was a real driving force in me doing this book. I have to thank him quite a bit for it. He said, told me it was something that I had to do. But it kind of falls back on, you know, I got into this side of our sport because, you know, I remember when I first got into fly fishing, it was really difficult to kind of find, like, really good information out there. I mean, things have since changed in the last 10 to 15 years with the advent of the Internet, and I think people are readily sharing more information. So when I first got into, you know, the guiding side of things and then the fly tying side of things, I started out with videos. That's kind of what I'm known for, is a lot of the tying videos I did. And you know, I kind of did things in reverse. Some people are like, oh, you know, why'd you put those videos out there? You know, you're going to do a book after the fact. You could have done it in reverse, I guess. But I guess that's kind of my sharing, giving nature, so to speak. But one of my biggest things with the videos was, you know, there's a lot. I've seen a litany of phenomenal tires over the years. But there's, you know, definitely a fine line or a distinct line between those that could not only just tie a very good fly, but they could also explain all the good things behind it, the who, the what, the where, the why, the when, and, you know, why they devised that. So what better way for me to kind of talk about a lot of the flies and how I fish them and the patterns that I kind of devised over time than through a book? So that's kind of was the whole driving force behind it.
Okay, great, great. Well, we'll start out real simply here. We did get a question, and what we're going to do, folks, is Rich has agreed to kind of going to march through his book and take each section and pick out, Richard picked out a fly or two that we're going to talk about how it's tied and so forth and then how it's fished and that kind of thing. But we did get a question in from Eric in Bloomsdale, Missouri, who's just kind of getting started into this. And I think this is a good question because we may have other people just getting started into tying and so forth. But he says, I am new to fly tying and wants to know what starter materials would you recommend for, well, he says rainbows and browns and Missouri rivers. And he says he usually goes to Montauk, Bennett Springs, and going to try North Fork of the White River and West Plains. But just in general, what do you, you know, when somebody, even a young teenager comes up to you, Rich, and says, well, where do I start with tying? What do I need? How do you direct
them? Yeah. Great question. You know, there's a couple different schools of thought. I know I can speak from experience. I'm a self-taught fly tyer. I had taken lessons like way after the fact. So I started with a basic universal tying kit, I think it was, that my aunt had gotten me. And I learned through a book. And that particular tying kit went through about, I don't know, probably 6 to 8 different patterns. And they supplied you with all the materials, the basic vise. And then I learned from a book. Now it's so much easier, in my opinion, because of the advent of the Internet. You can basically go out there, pull up the YouTube or Vimeo or any one of those video channels, plug in any kind of flies or anything of that nature, and you can learn how to tie without having to get the books. You can do it right offline, and then you can figure out what materials you want to get from there. I would do things a little differently now than what I did back in the day. In fact, I think some of the fly tying kits that are out there now, they're in a dire need of a facelift. You know, when it comes to learning out how to tie, some of the traditional patterns that we all learn how to tie first might not be as applicable as they were back in the day as now. I think fishing conditions and the number of people that are fishing have kind of changed the way we the types of flies that we tie and fish more readily. We'll talk about that a little bit more later with the chapters in the book. But I would, instead of going out and buying an entire kit, I would probably just get a basic vise, some like tools, you know, your a bodkin, maybe a bobbin or two, nothing crazy, a few different colors of thread, and start with something basic. And when I say basic, right up to like a pattern like a zebra midge or a thread midge, something that's very, very simple, has maybe one or two materials in it. That's a pattern that you can fish in a multiple different settings. You could use it as a dropper for a dry fly. You could fish it in an nymphing system, whatever. But you're going to learn some basic techniques with just those two materials and then build from there. And the best thing you could do with a couple of different colors of thread, you can cover some different bases with that particular pattern. But also, after you tie it 6 to 12 times and you feel like you can confidently tie that pattern consistently in that amount of time, then you can move on to another pattern, and that one's cataloged in the back of your head. So, and then you can move on to something a little different. But I think if you stay basic, rather than going out and buying all kinds of stuff, you know, find a pattern on the internet that you like. You could pop into your local shop, find out what's kind of going on there, and then take it from there. And I think that's kind of a better approach, because, you know, we all get into fly tying for, I hate to say this, it's kind of the wrong reason. We think we're going to save money when we do it, but inevitably, you never save money. You end up spending more.
Yeah.
But that's kind of the advice I would give. I think now that, you know, like I said, things are a little bit different, you can keep it relatively minimalistic and start out with one simple fly like that, and then, you know, once you feel confident, you can replicate it after, you know, 6 to 12 times and move on to something else. And like I said, you have that cataloged in your head.
Yeah, I think the other thing, me looking back too, I started the same way you did probably years earlier, but yeah, the internet just wasn't there back then. It didn't exist.
Right. You know, it's good and bad.
I know I learned from a guy that lived a couple doors down from me, and he taught my friend and I how to tie flies. And I think that's the other aspect, is if you can hook up with a local club. A lot of the shops have fly tying demos on Saturdays, you know. And,
Absolutely. And
check that out, too, and try to probably buy materials that you can use for more than one fly, too. You know, some of the things. I remember things were so expensive for me when I started that we actually, friend and I rode our Stingray bikes. We were in junior high school. Stingray bikes across to the other side of Boulder. We're living in Boulder, Colorado, to a chicken farm. We went out and asked the guy at the chicken farm, do you have any dead chickens?
Right.
He goes, yeah, they die here every day. Here's a couple. So he handed them to us, and we rode back with our Stingray bikes with holding chickens by their necks all the way back home. Nice. And then I think I still have some of those feathers around somewhere, but, of course, they were all white back then. They were just regular old white chickens, but you did whatever you had to do to get some feathers, let's put it that way.
Yeah, we're pretty lucky now. I mean, the materials that we have at our disposal are so much better. I mean, you know, genetically engineered feathers from some of the birds now, it's pretty amazing. We're in a pretty great time, you know.
Yeah, excellent materials. But, okay, well, good. Well, let's hopefully that helps, Eric, and, get like you said, get started simple and work your way up and keep adding to your inventory, and before long you'll have spent thousands and thousands of dollars on equipment and material. Okay, so you broke your book down basically into three parts. Part one, dry flies and emergers, part two, nymphs, and part three, streamers. So let's just follow the organization of your book here and talk about dry flies and emergers first. What things, first of all, do you consider when designing dry flies and emergers? What goes through your head? How do you go about maybe even coming up with a new pattern, and why?
Okay, I talk about this in a presentation that I give in relation to this book, and I think this kind of will delve into it a little bit better. I like to keep things simple. You talked about it early on, how I guided on the river, the Farmington River, and to put things in perspective, and it kind of hits on the subtitle, you know, toughest fish and strategies for fishing them and tying flies for it. That's a river that gets an extreme amount of pressure. So to kind of put things in perspective, our catch and release area on our upper section of the river, which is roughly like 4 miles, on any given season gets between 125 and 150,000 hours of fishermen a year. So for a very small section, those fish get conditioned. I don't like to say they get educated. We like to put them on a pedestal a little bit. But let's face it, they're fish. They have small brains. They get conditioned. So they realize that there's going to be a negative response after, you know, they take a hook to the mouth so many times. So you have to kind of fish patterns that are going to relatively work. But in that respect, they don't have to be super crazy. I mean, I'll be the first guy to tell you, when it comes to fishing, it's not so much the fly, the presentation trumps everything, but when you have those days that are tough, you might need something that's a little bit outside the box, and that's where being a tire kind of helps. So when I say simple, dry flies and emergers, you want to look at the major characteristics of the most vulnerable stage of that particular insect. So I talk about it a little bit in the book, and I talk about it in the presentation. Take a mayfly. So one of the most vulnerable stages in the mayfly is when it emerges. Now, not all mayflies emerge in the film. Some do emerge off the bottom of the river, but a majority of them do. And the most vulnerable stage of that is when they're actually shedding that exoskeleton from that nymphal shuck and then trying to dry off their wings and then fly away from the stream. So there's three major parts there, okay? And your flies should kind of hold those three major attributes. Now, if you were to look at it in a picture, I realize I can't really display that right now because we're talking on the phone, but what are the three things you have? You have a shuck, a body, and a wing for the most part, right? So those are the three major things you need to kind of replicate when you're trying to design those types of flies. And I tell people, you know, a lot of the patterns that I show you in here, these aren't like extra revolutionary type patterns. There's a lot of borrowed ideas and techniques in there from other places, but they're simplified. You know, I found over time that fishing to pressured fish and to wild trout to a degree in some other places, you needed patterns that, especially for dries and emergers, that rode flush in the film. So a lot of those beautiful Catskill-style dry flies that we all kind of grew up learning how to tie for some of our dry flies to begin with were a little less effective in some of those slack water conditions. So I found that those patterns that rode flush in the film that weren't heavily hackled were kind of the be-all, end-all flies for me for the most part. And to be quite honest with you, and I tell people when it comes to mayflies, I fish nothing but emergers unless there's a spinnerfall, because that's hands down probably the most vulnerable stage of any of that whole insect's emergence pattern. So very, very rarely do I fish duns.
Well, wow. Oh, that's a big revelation. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. Good. Okay. So well, what about, you know, the characteristics of dry flies and emergers? You know, you talked about the shuck. And so in what order do you rank those characteristics as far as...
Okay, so I break it down a little differently. So there's definitely some importance there. I think you know, there's size and shape are probably kind of universal in my opinion. So when you're going to try and replicate whatever those insects are, you have to make sure that the size and the shape are relatively close to the natural. So it's kind of like this. It's like when I guide it, it's the same thing. I think it's fantastic, and it's awesome if you know all the Latin terms for all your insects that you fish for. It's pretty cool, and you know, you can kind of show off to your friends a little bit. You know, you can, you know, break out some of those Latin terms. But at the end of the day, and I used to do this when I guided, keep it simple. You know, so if you're out there on the water and you've got some insects, mayflies, we'll say, for example, that are, you know, roughly a size 16 or 18, the bodies of them is a light olive, and they have an upright, you know, dark dun colored wing, then I want to try and find something in my fly box that's relatively close to that. Because at the end of the day, the fish don't really care if it's, you know, what the Latin name is. They just want to find something that's similar to what they're eating for the most part. So I think the size and the shape of it is probably the utmost of importance, and their footprint. And then I would say that the color is probably a little less important. So you want to make sure you have a pattern that's close in size. The shape, which is the proportions, need to be close too. So essentially what that means is, you have to get really adept at paying attention to what's going on in the river, number one, and taking a look at those insects and making sure that you don't overdress your flies. The color, I say, is the least important, because there are times when you're out there, and I use some of the rivers that we have in the Northeast. We'll take the West Branch of the Delaware, for example. Phenomenal dry fly fishery, probably hands down one of the best in the Northeast, if not arguably the best river for dry fly fishing. It gets prolific sulfur hatches. In the summer, like clockwork, they come off every day. Some days they're so thick, every square inch of the river is coated with these things, and the fish are feeding on them. So it can be really difficult to pick your fly out, or for the fish to pick your fly out, when there's thousands of these things floating downstream. So sometimes in a situation like that. If you've got a fly that's slightly off in color, you can, you know, it gives the trout something a little different to distinguish from all the naturals in the river. And sometimes the shape as well, if it's a size bigger, can sometimes be the difference. But I think if you were going to have a pecking order, you'd probably be with the size, shape, and then color in that particular order. I think that's probably the most important.
Okay, so what fly do you want to talk about here? We're talking about dries and emergers. And I'm assuming it's going to be an emerger since you said that's what you fish most often.
Yep. While we're talking about mayflies, I'll talk about pretty much the one mayfly I fish all the time, and I'll tell you how that kind of came about. It's the shucked up emerger. And to be quite honest with you, this fly, and I tell people when I talk about it, I didn't reinvent the wheel here, folks. I mean, I borrowed some materials and some ideas from some other patterns, and essentially this fly is nothing more than another variation of a snowshoe rabbit emerger, okay? I designed it because, I've got an OCD side of me. I know last time when you had me on, I talked about streamers. It's kind of like my first love, but I kind of consider myself a jack of all trades. And when it comes to trout fishing, I try to be good at just about anything. I think that's how you can be most adept. Now, when it comes to fishing flies, too, there's certain things that I always like to have something a little different. And I think as a fly tier, I think you have a distinct advantage over the average fisherman who doesn't tie his own flies, because you can take, if you're fishing a river that's very, very heavily pressured, you have the ability to fine-tune or tweak or just alter a couple materials in a pattern that might save the day on some of those tougher days. So I designed the shucked up emerger because, here's the thing, I had a love-hate relationship with CDC. Now, if any of you tie with CDC, it's an awesome little feather. It comes from the oil glands of the duck or a goose near their rear. It floats very well until it gets relatively wet. It's extremely light. So you can have, even if you boot a cast or you don't throw a good cast well, it lands relatively softly on the water. The downside to it is once you catch a fish on it, it's a pain in the neck to tease back into shape to fish with again. So once it gets a little fish slime on it, that's it. You'll spend a majority of your time teasing and, running that stuff through powdered floating to try and get it presentable so that it'll float again. So that was my biggest thing. So when I kind of got into tying with snowshoe, what I liked about snowshoe was the fact that it was, A, pretty readily available, relatively inexpensive, floated like a cork, and it was so much easier for me to tease back into shape. So to be honest with you, I started to go out on a trip out west to Montana. I was going to go out to the Bighorn in April one year with a good friend of mine who used to live out there. And he's like, hey, tie up some betis patterns, olive emergers, because there's really good olive hatches that time of year. I'm like, okay. So he told me a few patterns that worked pretty well, and I wanted something that was a little different. So at the time, I had found a hook, and it was all based upon one style of a hook, which you no longer can get. Go figure, right? there was a hook out there by, it was called a dolphin shank emerger, which was kind of a strange name. It was made by TMC. They no longer can make it, but it's essentially a jig-style hook, which they use for emergers. So picture a straight, regular-length hook, and then the last quarter near the eye of the hook was bent at a 45-degree angle. So essentially how this particular fly would ride is, if you designed it correctly, that bent section near the eye would ride in the surface film, and the rest of the hook would hang below the surface, if you can kind of visualize that. So the whole idea for me was I wanted to incorporate a fly that it had that snowshoe emerger rabbit foot wing, but it would only have a body and a shuck and a wing, and that was it. So this fly gave me, this hook gave me the perfect canvas to do that. I since had to improvise on it, use different hooks for it, but that's kind of why I designed it. And I took that particular pattern out to the Bighorn. It did very, very well. The next season I used it extensively on my home waters. And what I liked about it was I could, by just changing a couple materials, the body color and the wing color, I could cover all my mayfly emergences within reason. The only limiting factor was, the length of the rabbit fur that I had. So, but for the most part, I had one pattern that could cover all those bases. So that was a win-win for me.
Yeah. It's I'm seeing here you've got Slate Drake, March Brown, Chocolate Dunn, Blue Wing Olive, Dark Hendrickson, PMD, and that covers a lot of bases.
Yeah,
so,
you know.
So when you're talking, you know, like when we were talking at the beginning of the show, too, and, mm-hmm. and we were answering the question about, you know, what materials to get, here's a case where once you learn how to tie this one fly, you get a lot of mileage out of it by just changing up a couple materials.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I've tied it for people all over the country for pretty much every mayfly hatch you can think of. And like I said, the only real limiting factor there, and I talk about it in the book, is, you know, the length of the rabbit fur that you get. And if you can get some really good feet, you can actually tie, you know, hexes on this thing, which is like one of the largest mayflies around. So
what's, if you're getting the snowshoe rabbit, what length would you be looking for? I mean, you go hand pick them, you're probably looking for something there.
Well, that's you bring up a great question. The best thing, and this is some good information for Eric in his first question there too, is, and it goes hand in hand with buying materials. So if you're going to purchase materials, there's certain things that I think you can purchase blind. And when I mean blind, that's the stuff that you can purchase off the internet. So what falls into that realm are any of your synthetic materials. So your synthetic materials, they're engineered by man, so you should have 100% yield there, okay? When you start getting into natural materials like, you know, furs and feathers, those are things that you're going to want to go into your shop, take a look at. And your shop owners are going to really have no problem, unless you're manhandling this stuff and tearing it apart, with you taking it out of the package and inspecting it. You know, most of these packages come in Ziploc bags anyway. So, you know, when it comes to tying that particular fly, and back to the snowshoe rabbit, you know, pull those feet out, take a look at them, and believe it or not, I was of the school of thought, because I was told by somebody who had a heck of a lot more experience than me that there was only one section of the rabbit foot that you could really use, and that was the heel. But with a little bit of trial and error and, you know, thinking to myself, well, why would I want to continue to waste the rest of this hair when, you know, I have this whole other piece of the foot there? You can tie with all that hair on the bottom of the foot all the way up to the toes. Now, the biggest thing is you're going to have some limiting factors there. So once you get away from the heel of the foot and you get closer to the toes, the fibers take on a little bit different characteristic. They're a little bit more crinkly. They have the tendency to be hard, not like the stuff near the heel. The heel's a lot softer, so it compresses. It'll actually bind to the hook a heck of a lot easier. When you start tying with the stuff near the toes, which is actually longer, it still floats just as well, but you may have to do a couple of little things to utilize this stuff. So the best advice I can give you is you want to make sure you lay a thread base down before you tie any of those things, those fibers in. You may even have to put a little drop of super glue on there to prevent it from rolling, because if you don't secure that correctly or with enough thread pressure, when you go to dub that or you go to tie that on the head, it's going to spin around the hook. So that's probably one of the biggest tips I can give you on tying that particular fly.
Okay. Otherwise, no tricks, other tricks to tying
in? A couple of little things you can do. You can kind of, you definitely want, when you go to, especially on the smaller flies, when you're tying any one of those mayflies that's under like a 16, so from a 16 and smaller, what you're going to want to do is make sure that you cut the butt ends of that snowshoe rabbit hair kind of at a 45-degree angle, because that's going to actually help you build a taper, a natural taper to the fly. So when I say at a 45-degree angle, 45-degree angle from the eye of the hook rearward, so you have a 45-degree angle, if that makes sense. So as you go closer to the eye of the hook, it's going to taper down towards at a triangle angle, if that makes sense. So for a lot of your smaller flies with that particular one, I like to dub all of mine, and I talk about the dubbing, the two types of dubbing I like, any type of a rabbit-style dubbing for anything larger, like a 14 and bigger. So that could be like a hair's ear dubbing or a spectrumized dubbing. And then once I get to flies under that size, like a 16 and smaller, you're going to need something that's a lot finer. So like a super fine dubbing would work. But if you're finding that you've built up a little bit too much bulk, or, you know, the head of your fly looks disproportionate, and if you're going to dub it, then you can absolutely use just thread to build that body section of that portion of the fly.
Okay, good. Okay, we're going to take a quick break here. Richard, when we come back, let's talk about how you fish this fly, okay? Mm-hmm. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, They will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at frontrangeanglers.com. Again, that's frontrangeanglers.com. If you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, we're talking with Rich Strolis about catching shadows. And if you'd like to ask Rich a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Rich, I always ask my guests at this point in the show, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world? I know just finishing this book this past year was what you were doing for the past year or more, but what's happening with you?
It's kind of been like a sigh of relief. It was a huge weight off my shoulders to finally finish that. Writing a book is a monumental task. I did enjoy it, though. It was actually, believe it or not, this sounds kind of crazy. I know some of the other guys that have written books might disagree, but I actually had a lot of fun writing it. So it was. It's great to have that done. I'm in the thick of show season right now, so I've been out there kind of hitting the pavement, so to speak, every weekend, all over the place, doing all the fly fishing shows just to promote the book and doing some other venues too. I was out in Denver. In fact, that's where I met you in person for the first time back in January. I was just out in Michigan last week at Schultz Outfitters. They have a wonderful event there called Barflies. They invited me out for that. It was fantastic. Essentially how that works is they have a bar right down the street from there, and we all kind of get together, and they have it set up a camera on a big screen, and I tie a fly, and then we tie it all together, and you know, we get to eat and have beers in between, and then they keep the shop open, and we go back and talk fish until, you know, the wee hours of the night. So that was kind of cool. And then I've got a bunch of other stuff kind of on the burner for this year. I had a fantastic trip out to Alaska with my good friend Mike Schmidt last year. We went up to Alaska in the Yukon River drainage for northern pike. It was everything I had imagined it to be. And then I got some other trips going on this year. It looks like I'm going to be out in Wyoming in April at the fly shop of the Bighorns. They're bringing myself out and a bunch of other tires. And then I've got the Lancaster Fly Fishing Show coming up and the Midwest Fly Expo. And then hopefully some camping and fishing with the wife and kids this year. And I actually got my daughters, they don't know this yet, but they've got their first fly rod outfits and Tenkara rods for themselves. I think I'm going to start them out with those.
How old are they?
Well, my youngest daughter, Nora, just turned 6 yesterday, and then Tessa turns 8 on the 1st of March. So I think they're right at a perfect age to learn how to start getting into that. So they love to fish as it is.
Yeah. Sounds like fun. Good. Okay, well, thanks for sharing that. We did get a question, Rich, here off the Internet, kind of a follow-up to what we were talking about. James in Alpine, Wyoming wrote, now that special emerger hook is not available, can you bend the top portion of the hook to achieve the same effect?
Absolutely, you could. The only thing I will warn you is when you start to bend hooks, you'll create a weak spot in the metal. So if you do hook a relatively good fish on it, there's a chance that it might break. So the best advice I can give you, and I talk about it in the book, is I found a couple alternative hooks to use. So one of the hooks that I use now is essentially just a clinkhammer style hook. So there's a few companies that make the clinkhammer hook. Daiichi's one. Partridge is my preferred one because they make a barbless style one now. Or you could take any style of, scud hook, which would work, lighter wire. You don't want to use something heavy because you'll probably sink the fly. So that would be my number one choice for that particular pattern.
Okay, good. Okay, so let's talk a little bit how you fish this pattern. Do's, don'ts, time and place. Can you enlighten us on that a bit?
Sure. Like I said, this particular pattern, I designed it around some of the tougher fish, and that typically we find a lot of the rising fish and some of the better rising fish here in the Northeast and some of the other places I fished, they typically take up feeding lies in some of the slack water or the more like still water settings. So, those heavily hackle patterns were a lot less effective in those types of water. So essentially what I wanted to do, this isn't a pattern that, you can fish it in some broken water. I do use it as a searching pattern when I'm fishing for in mountain streams for brook trout and stuff. I never leave home without a few of those in my small stream box. But if I'm out there on a big river, and I've got some selective fish that are usually in those types of margins. I like to fish this a couple different ways. The first way is I'm not a big fan of casting directly upstream unless I absolutely have to, because more often than not, if I've got a rising fish above me, I'm kind of at a bit of a disadvantage. Chances are I'm probably going to drop my fly line over their feeding line. If they're a spooky fish, they're going to go running to the hills. So I typically want to get myself in a position that's upstream of my target. So this is kind of a tactic we used on the Delaware. You know, you get upstream of where that fish is. You might either be directly upstream and you cast, you do a steeple-type cast, so you'll stop your rod high, and it's kind of a George Harvey used to use this with his slack leader tactic. You'd stop your rod high, and then your line would fall to the water in a series of S-curves, and you're basically, the fish is downstream from you, and he's going to see the fly first as opposed to seeing your leader, the fly line, et cetera. That's right. Probably my number one way to approach fish that are feeding in the surface under those types of conditions. And that's usually when you make that first cast count, you can more often than not fool those fish into eating that particular fly. The second way that I will fish this, you can actually use this particular pattern in a dry dropper rig. So there's a couple different ways you can fish dries and droppers with a pair of dry flies, but I'm referring to having the shucked up merger as my dry fly slash indicator and then fishing a smaller, lightly weighted nymph below it, anywhere from 6 inches on the short side to a couple feet long tippet section, which I usually tie right off the eye of that hook. So that way, I will typically fish that a little bit different. And that's more or less when I'm kind of searching. So if I've got a period of time where there's not a lot of surface activity going on or it's sparse, and I'm kind of trying to, locate some fish, then I'll fish in this manner. And I will actually be casting upstream on some of those slower margins and some of those moderate riffles below some of the faster water, at an upstream angle. And if I have to, I can put a little bit of a mend in there to slow it down. But that's one of the few times that I'll typically fish that, or the two styles that I most prevalently fish that particular fly.
Now, when that's floating in the film, that fly, the hook is actually down below the film, and you said you fish it kind of like an indicator, so you can readily see that chuck on the surface? Is that the way
you float? You won't see the chuck on the surface. The chuck will actually be below the surface. The only thing that you're going to see is the wing. So the wing is the upright portion and then just maybe a little bit of the body. So
okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, I guess what I meant is the wing. Yeah. Because of the snowshoe rabbit aspect of it, right? Okay, good. Okay, let's jump over and talk about nymphs then next.
Okay.
So, same thing, give us some background about how you think about nymphs in the way of design and use and so forth, as you did with the dry flies emergence.
So, same thing, I try to keep it simple, but I break my nymphs down into like three different categories. I have, and I look at designing nymphs based upon where I particularly want to fish that style of a nymph in the water column. So the three types, of nymphs I like to fish are those that are weighted, those that are unweighted, and then some that are moderately weighted. So you've got three of them, three different types there. So that's one of the three major attributes I look at first. So there's a couple different ways of fishing nymphs. You can fish them. I know George has talked about this and several other people you've had on. You can fish in some sort of a tight line rig, or you can fish with a suspension device or an indicator. So those things also kind of play into how I'm going to design these particular nymphs. If I'm going to be fishing something in some sort of a tight line setup, I'm probably going to be more apt to fish a pattern that's less of an exact imitation of a particular type of nymph, because those are situations or styles of nymphing that work relatively well in broken water, pocket water, faster water. So those are places where the fish doesn't have a lot of time to sit there and inspect your offering. So they have to make a split section, a second decision on whether they want to eat it or not. So I'm less concerned on whether that particular fly is a more of a direct match to what's in the water, but I'm more concerned about the weight of it. So that particular style of fly, it's going to have some sort of weight incorporated in it, so that's going to determine that I'm probably going to need something that's weighted. It might be tied in the round, moderately suggestive, et cetera. Now, if I'm fishing, I'm going to be tying a particular style of nymph that I might fish under a suspension device, I may want it lightly weighted or I may not want any weight in it. Because a lot of times when I'm fishing with an indicator, I'm adding weight to the line. That's what's going to get my fly down into the zone. So, and those are types of flies, sometimes they may be suggestive, they might be a little bit more realistic. I'm more of the thought of, and I talk about this, it doesn't matter what type of fly I'm tying or creating, but there's one major attribute that I like to incorporate in a lot of my fly patterns, whether it's a nymph, a dry, or a streamer, is I like materials that have inherent motion or movement to them, because that gives off the idea of something that's lifelike or that it's alive, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So those particular flies, any one of those ones that I tie, I like to use materials, whether it's synthetic or natural, that it'll move without me having to impart any kind of movement to that fly. So a lot of those unweighted nymphs are going to have more movement-rich types of materials, and that makes sense.
Okay. All right. And then, so let's talk about then, I think you picked out the woven mayfly.
Mm-hmm.
And let's dig into that. Why you designed that one, and this looks a bit more complicated to tie than the shucked up emerger. So.
Yeah, I have, you know, it's funny. I have, when it comes to the nymphs chapter, I run the gamut of flies. I have very, very simple nymphs in there up to some moderately complex nymphs. Now, when I say moderately complex, my simple nymphs take 1 to 3 minutes for me to tie. And they're generally patterns that, you know, if I lose them, I want them simple. They're designed around, you know, guiding situations for the most part. But I wanted them simple because of the simple fact that, you know, you lose a lot of nymphs when you're nymph fishing if you're fishing them correctly. Just because you may hang the bottom, you know, you might be fishing lighter tippet, break them off on a fish. Inevitably, you might hook the bushes behind you, et cetera. So I wanted to tie a lot of my nymph patterns that I wouldn't feel so bad if I lost them. Now, I will tell you this. There's a few in there, like this one that we're going to talk about now, that's a little bit more involved. So the woven mayfly itself is one of the biggest things that I told you. I have this little OCD side of me when it comes to flies. You know, I see certain things with, you know, and this is just the learning part of it, or, you know, the creative side of things for me. You know, you look at some of the mayfly nymphs that get kicked loose in the drift, and, you know, I think triggers are big in nymph patterns, and triggers could be anything. It could be a ribbing. It could be a little bit of flash to make it look like something's, you know, starting to release gases. It's going to hatch, et cetera. But one of the major things that I noticed with some of your clinger nymphs, your mayflies, and a lot of your you know, medium-sized to large-sized nymphs, whether they're stoneflies or mayflies, is the fact that they have two distinct colors to them. They typically have a darker top and a lighter-colored bottom for the most part. So for me, like I said, that OCD side came out. You know, how can I effectively make a nymph pattern that's two-tone like that? Because I think in some instances, that's a major trigger. That's something that trout readily recognize when those flies are kicked loose in the drift, and they'll target that. So now, I remember a couple times being out there, whether I was guiding or fishing during a Henderson hatch, and pre-hatch, you could see the nymphs kind of rising through the water column, and you could see their, as they rolled through the water, their light-colored underbody. So I'm like, you know, that's got to be a trigger. So experimented with it. The easiest way for me to do that was once they started showing how to do, they got really prevalently popular in the U.S. here in like the last 10 years was some of the, you know, the woven nymphs the Czechs had come up with. So most of those are tied on like a curved scud style hook, you know. So I was like, why don't I incorporate that onto a straight hook into a some sort of a mayfly design and take it from there. And that's kind of how I design that particular pattern. Like I said, it's nothing that I, you know, revolutionary that I created, but I just borrowed some ideas and kind of tied them a little different.
Yeah, well, you make a good point, you know, that I can just see that in my mind, you know, the mayfly tumbling through the water, and it would be like, you know, a flashing thing of seeing the light, dark, you know.
And, absolutely.
It's got to be a big trigger, you know, I would think. So I think you're right on with that analysis. Well, tell us then, you know, some tips about tying this one, because it is, and how long does it take you to tie one of these now that you've got it down pat?
This particular one is, I would say it's a moderate nymph, so for me, and then granted, this comes with practice, you know, I mean, for the average tire, this is probably going to take you a little bit longer, but once you get the hang of it, you can rip these things out pretty quick. I'd say it's like under a 5-minute tie, so probably about 4 to 5 minutes if I'm really cranking them out. So
okay.
One of the biggest tips I can give you, and I learned this from a guy in my neck of the woods called Jerry Johns. He's kind of like an unspoken, very soft-spoken, quiet guy, wealth of knowledge. Doesn't like to be in the limelight type thing, but he was a phenomenal tire, still is, tied commercially. One of the biggest tips he gave me was tying any kind of woven pattern, because the hardest thing is when you try to do these woven-style bodies is maintaining the proper pressure on the material that you're using to weave the body in. And if you take any pressure off of it or put too much, the pattern's not going to come out correctly. And you'll see, if you try to weave a fly body by hand, it's very, very difficult. It can be very, very problematic. So what he taught me how to do is take your embroidery thread or whatever you use, whether it's small yarn, and spool it. So take some of your old thread spools, and then I use the embroidery yarn, I think it's the Coates and Clark or the DMC floss or one of the other ones I use there. It's a 6-strand floss. So typically for some of these smaller nymphs, you want to break this down into 3 strands. So for like 37 cents a piece, a package of this stuff, you get an exorbitant amount of floss. So take the floss and split it. So you'll have 2 bunches of 3 strands. And then wrap that particular floss onto one of your old spools and then put on a bobbin. So when you go to weave the body of this particular fly, you use a pair of bobbins. And you can maintain the pressure on the floss so much easier. And you'll see, once you get the hang of it, you can crank these things out relatively quickly.
That's a good tip, because, you can keep the tension much easier with spool. Yeah.
Absolutely. Probably the second biggest tip I can give you, and this doesn't just go for this pattern, it goes for any kind of pattern that you're going to do a woven body, or you've got to build up an underbody in a particular color. You know, one of the local guys around here who's just starting to get into tying the other day, I was talking with him because he's been tying for the shop, and he was like, it takes me forever to do these woven flies because I'm using so much thread, to coat, because there's lead wire and stuff under there for extra weight. And he's like, in order for me to coat all that, I've got to spend a lot of time spinning all this thread on there. And I'm like, well, of course you are. I'm like, one of the best tips I can give you for that is there's a material out there, and the late Dick Tallur made this stuff popular called Uni-Stretch. And it's essentially like a yarn. It's a stretchable yarn that Uni makes, but it's much thicker in diameter. You can use that for the underbody on your nymph, and you can basically take 1 to 2 courses of this stuff in a matter of seconds, and you've coated all that underbody. So now you don't have any lead wire bleeding through or anything. And you can just do that and then set your flies aside and then come back and tie them afterwards. And that will drastically cut down the time on the construction of this particular fly.
Hmm. Okay. And what was that called again? It was made by Uni?
Yeah, it's called Uni Stretch.
Uni Stretch. Okay. Okay. And, okay. Before we jump in to how to fish this, let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and talk about how to fish this woven mayfly. So stick with me, folks. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com. Their fishing products and guide services that they offer in both Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide services in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Rich Strolis about catching shadows. If you'd like to ask Rich a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, so, Rich, tell us how you fish this mayfly pattern.
This one, like I said, it's a weighted fly, so I would typically fish this in some sort of a tight line setup, like a Czech-style rig, a Polish-style rig. It's a moderately weighted fly, so it's not super light, in my opinion. I usually tie this for some of your medium-sized mayflies. So I'm usually fishing this on a short-line rig. When I say short-line, less than 9-foot leader, through relatively faster water, and it gets down relatively fast. I could use it as an anchor pattern, or I could use it as a dropper, per se. But it's typically I'll get myself in a position in some moderately fast water, pocket water, things of that nature, riffles, drop-offs, and I'll cast upstream and, you know, kind of lead my flies and work my drift through a particular run. I will tell you this, you can, if you want to tie this a little differently and that's not a style of fishing that you're comfortable with, you can use this under an indicator rig. You could omit the tungsten bead and use a brass bead to make it a little lighter if you are inclined. Sometimes I'll tie some of these with an undersized bead, and I will use them as a dropper under a relatively large foam-style dry fly pattern as a searching pattern. I've used them out west with some really good success. Or you can even tie it larger, and same thing, use it as a really heavy anchor, because this fly kind of does dual purpose. It's not just the mayfly. You can tie it in a larger size. I tie some of these up to like a 6 or a 4 with two tungsten beads on it, which sounds crazy, and use it as like a giant stonefly in a pinch. So same thing, though. It's a tight line rig style fly, so you want to maintain contact with it as you're fishing it through some of the faster water. That being said, I think it kind of loses its effectiveness when it's a moderately weighted fly once you start getting into some of that slack water below some of those riffles and deeper runs. So it's definitely a fast pocket water style fly.
Now, yeah, and when I first turned to the page, I thought it was a stone fly from the one picture you had in there. It very much looks like. So you never tie this without the weight?
You can. I do. I have some in my fly box currently that, you know, I kind of break them down by rows. And like I said, I try to keep things simple. I find a couple patterns I like, and then I just make variations of those. And I don't really go out onto the river with a plethora of equipment. So I'm usually like a one or two fly box kind of guy, just kind of gotten, you know, over time and experience, figured out what's going on at certain times of the year, and then I kind of simplify it, because I think if you go out there with everything under the, you know, in the kitchen sink on your person, like 50 to 20 different boxes of flies, when you have a tough day, you're going to sit there ripping your hair out of your head trying to figure out what you're going to try and catch these fish on. So, yeah, I have probably one or two rows in that particular box that has those nymphs that are lightly weighted to not weighted hardly at all. With either you can even tie them with a glass bead if you want to. I haven't tried them, but I'm sure it would work. But like with brass beads instead of tungsten. So.
Yeah. Okay, good. Okay, let's talk about one of your favorite subjects. Oh, we did have a couple questions in this, so let me grab these questions first.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Franco in Richmond, Virginia asks, what do you think about employing a hotspot on your nymphs?
I think hotspots are good and bad. It all depends. So I think you need to let the fish let you know if that's something that's going to trigger a bite. So what I mean by that is hotspots definitely have their place. I think hotspots on nymphs, especially through faster water, are much more effective as opposed to fishing in like some of your slack water, per se. So, and the big thing with hotspots is you don't want them too big. From my experience, most of the hotspots that I tie on my flies might only be like a small little couple turns of thread, you know, like a bright chartreuse or fluorescent orange or things of that nature. You don't really want to have them extremely gaudy. They do have a time and a place. I think there are days when the hot spots will definitely outproduce a fly that doesn't have them, and then there's also those other days when vice versa. So I think it's a good practice to have some, if you have a particular fly pattern or nymph pattern that you like, tie some up with hot spots and some without. You don't want to limit yourself to just one style of one or the other. Because that way there's going to be days when you might find that one or the other is going to work, and you want to have some variety in your fly box, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And then a question from Rick Takahashi, who has been on our show a number of times as well. He says, Rich, great meeting you at the Denver Fly Fishing Show. I just received your new book, have skimmed through it, but not have been able to sit down and read it in depth. Looks mighty fine to me on first glance. What is your favorite setup for fishing in streams and rivers with smaller nymphs or flies?
Probably favorite setup, I'm assuming he's probably talking about like rod, that type thing, and then like my rigging, like my leader and whatnot.
Probably more so rigging, I would think, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm an advocate of longer rods when it comes to nymphs, even on, you know, streams and rivers. I think you have more control that way. So typically, I like to have a versatile leader, something that I can easily switch between many of the different styles, whether it's fishing with an indicator or if I'm going to fish a tight line setup. So I usually have some sort of my butt section of my leader is pretty much the same. So I'll run like about an 8 to a 9 foot section if it's going to be a smaller stream with two-tone type material. So that could be like Maxima for a butt section, and it might be like maybe 20 pounds for helping for turnover. And then I would taper that down to maybe some Amnesia, you know, either like the bright red or the chartreuse color, like a 3 or 4 foot section there. And that's kind of like my butt section on my leader. And I'll usually use some sort of a tippet ring, whether it's a 3 millimeter or a 2 millimeter tippet ring tied onto the end of that. So that way I can, if I have to, I can put another taper leader on that if need be, or I could just tie straight tippet from there down. If I'm fishing a tight line rig, I'm probably going to use.
Are you there? Can't hear you, Rich. No, your phone is, I'm just hearing static. We can hang in here if you want to dial back in and try to get another connection, if you can hear me. We'll hang tight here.
You still can't hear me?
I could hear that, still can't hear me. I heard that, but you're breaking up so bad. It's really garbled, kind of. Anything happen on your end there?
No, I don't know what's going on.
Okay, talk a bit more so I can.
Yeah, I don't know. Can you hear me? I don't know what happened.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like you're underwater. Did you fall in the river?
I wish.
Well, go ahead and give it a shot. And
yeah, I don't know how much of that you caught.
There. Now you're back. Now you're back.
That's strange. I'm on a landline, too.
yeah, weird. It's just like, just cut you off.
Yeah, so what I was saying was, so I don't know if you got the butt section on my leader. Like I said, I try to use like a 20, 25-pound Maxima, usually like 4 to 5 feet, and then I'll put like 3 to 4 foot section of some sort of colored Amnesia, whether it's like red or chartreuse, like 15 pound, and then I run a tippet ring off of that. So the tippet ring allows me to, if I need to put a tapered leader on there, I can, to fish an indicator system, or I can use a straight piece of level tippet for a tight line setup. So that would usually be, I mean, my default tippet size for a level leader would be like a 5X tippet, and that could be anywhere from, and that's based off of the depth of the water I'm fishing. It could be 4 feet on the short end all the way up to like 10 feet, if that makes sense. So
okay.
That's kind of my favorite setup for that. It's a little more versatile. It allows me to fish at different lengths and stuff. So.
Okay, good. Well, let's, as I was starting to say before, let's talk about one of your favorite things, streamers.
Yep.
Again, you know, what are the design, you know, aspects that you think about with streamers? I know we did have a question. Let's see here. Oh, I think it's, I know it's on one of the online ones. I'll review that while you're talking about that. But tell us your considerations for designing streamers and characteristics that you like to incorporate.
Absolutely. I think, it's the same thing. I kind of break them down into three styles, you know, weighted, unweighted, and what I call transitional streamers. And all transitional streamers are ones that might have a little bit of weight built into them, but not so much that, you know, what I consider a weighted streamer would be one that I would fish on a floating line, like I talked about before, that plummets through the water column. So it's meant to be fished relatively close, if not right on the bottom of the stream. The unweighted ones are typically, in order to get them through the water column, or fished on some sort of a sinking type line, and those are going to have no weight added to the fly whatsoever, so they're neutrally buoyant. And then the transitional ones would be something that's got a little bit of weight to it, but not so much that it's going to give you that extreme vertical jigging motion like a heavily weighted fly would have. The next biggest thing, and this goes for anybody out there who's looking to design streamers for that matter, is, you know, you got to look at the biggest thing you need to take into consideration is what's the average size of the fish that you're targeting in the fishery that you call home or wherever you're going to be. So, you know, I know guys associate me with some of the larger streamers for trout, but there's definitely, you know, a fine line with, you know, what's too big, and then there's a definite fine line between what's an optimal size for consistently catching fish. So I think you need to really look at that before you delve into anything with designing those flies. So if you're going to take an average fishery where, you know, your trout might average, we'll say, 15 to 18 inches per se, you're probably average, you got to look at the average forage size in that particular river. Like, what are those fish keying in on the most, and what size is it? So you're probably going to want to make your fly relatively close to that for the most part. The other big thing, and I talked about it earlier tonight, is when you design, me personally, when I design streamers, I want flies that have materials in them that move on their own, so they have inherent motion. So basically what that means is when I have that streamer sitting in the water column and I'm not doing anything to it, that means just sitting there. I'm not stripping it. I'm not manipulating the rod. Those materials are moving, or they're at the mercy of the current. They move on their own. So they give off the idea that they're alive, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's with so many patterns, that seems to be the key, right? It triggers the lifelike movement of the flies. Right. So you picked out cellar dweller, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. And we did have a question about that from David Takawa. So, David,
sure.
I hope you're listening, and listen carefully because he's going to talk about the fly you're interested in. So, again, you know, why you designed this particular fly, and then let's dig into tips on tying it.
Sure. This was a fly that I was – if I remember correctly, back to one summer, had low water conditions, and this was prior to me even coming up with one of the sculpting patterns I had, but I needed a fly that I wanted to fish it on a floating setup. It had to have weight incorporated into it, needed to plummet through the water column. So during that particular year that I came up with this fly, we were experiencing kind of drought-like conditions, and, you know, I still wanted to fish streamers because I knew I could get some fish to eat these things even under those types of conditions, but I couldn't fish a sinking line. It would just be overkill, and I'd be on the bottom, you know, losing flies or running it through the fish. So I wanted something that was weighted on its own, was going to get down, and needed to ride kind of hook point up. I think that's a huge key factor when you're dealing with streamers that are weighted and meant to be fished near the bottom. Usually you want them to have them keeled with the hook point up, less of a chance they'll foul. So, you know, I always kind of, at the time, this was one of my earlier type streamers. It's a little more rudimentary compared to some of the stuff I tie now, but still equally as effective. You know, rabbit strips was one of the big things then. You know, the Zonker's a fly that I think a lot of us is, that's now considered a household term for a style of flies. When that first came out, you know, a rabbit strip fly, you know, the Zonker came out. Now anything that's tied with a rabbit strip is considered a Zonker style fly. So in order to incorporate some movement in that fly, I used the rabbit strip, but I used the hook is probably the most unique piece of that particular fly. And a lot of guys are tying on these types of hooks now. It's a jig hook. The very first ones that I tied on were on a 90-degree jig hook. It was a lighter wire Gamakatsu-style hook, so it has a distinct 90-degree bend up near the eye. Mm-hmm. That was a good hook for a while for me. But then one day I had a really large fish straighten one out, and I was like, I need something with heavier wire. So I went to a 60-degree flat eye hook. It's another Gamakatsu hook, which is like 2 to 3X heavy. So it was much heavier wire, which actually helped sink the fly a little better. And I've since kind of messed around with a lot of different ways of tying it. The first few I tied, I didn't have tungsten dumbbells at the time. I only had lead ones, so in order for me to weight this a little bit more, I had to wrap some lead on the shank of the hook and, you know, to get it to sink through the water column relatively fast. But what I noticed was sometimes those fish, I catch most of my larger fish, believe it or not, and guys kind of look at you funny until you kind of show them this, but a lot of the larger fish that I catch on even my home waters here are in water that's more often than not inches deep rather than feet deep, if that makes sense. So, you know, some of your big fish move into shallower water to feed at times, and you got to be at the right place at the right time. So if I'm fishing with a sinking line through water that's less than a couple feet deep, and I have a sinking line per se that sinks at 6 to 7 inches a second, in 2 to 3 seconds my line is on the bottom of the river. So not very stealthy approach when the water's low. So when I designed this fly, I needed something that was going to get down quick. And in order for me to do that, I had to incorporate a fair amount of weight into it. And it just, after tying it the first few times, and it's evolved a bit, and I talk about that in the book. I used to use wool in it. Now I use some different types of material. That was the biggest obstacle I was trying to figure out. So, and that's kind of why I designed it.
And now I'm a bit confused because the flat eye hook is, and I'm not familiar with jig hooks. So when you talk about in your book a flat eye jig 60 flat eye, but I look at the hook and it's not. I guess what I'm thinking is a straight eye. So this looks like it's bent at like maybe 45 degrees or so, right?
Yeah, it's a 60 degree bend, but instead 60. Of the eye, if you look at a lot of the jig hooks, all right, the hook eye itself, take a standard hook, all right? It's typically perpendicular, right, to the point or the bend, the gap. It's
right.
Offset by 90 degrees, correct?
Right.
So that would keep it flat. If you look at some of the jig hooks that are out there for streamer fishing, the hook eye itself is in line with the gap, if that makes sense. So that would keep it a regular ring eye as opposed to a flat eye. So if you take a standard hook, okay, per se, like we'll use the last one I used for the shucked up emerger, that would be a flat eye jig, per se, as opposed to, you know, I think Davey Watton popularized that specific style of hook where the eye is actually right in line with the shank and the gape. So that's the difference, if that makes sense. I probably didn't explain that very well, but. Do you kind of follow me now? with the eye a bit? All right,
yeah.
So say it's kind of hard for me to depict this. I'm a visual learner, so. It's
yeah, well, I'm looking
kinda,
at the picture, so that's why I'm, you know.
Yeah, so what a flat eye means is that the eye of the hook is 90 degrees offset with the gape of the hook itself.
Oh,
so,
okay, I gotcha.
Gotcha now, okay?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Whereas, like, some of the jigs that you have, there, it's not. So basically, if you're looking at the hook from a side profile, you're going to see the ring eye for where you're going to tie your fly on, as opposed to a flat eye, you're not, if that makes sense, because it's offset 90 degrees to the gape.
Yeah, okay, good. Okay, so let's see, we've got a few more minutes here. Other tips on tying this?
Yeah, what I would typically do with this fly, and this one's a relatively easy one to tie, to be quite honest with you, as opposed to some of the other streamers I have, I would pre-measure. I'm all about staging flies, especially if you're tying a bunch of these in succession. So I would take your rabbit strips, and I like to use Magnum rabbit strips on these. They're a little bit wider. You get a little bit more of a broader profile. So when I say Magnum, they're a quarter of an inch, not the eighth-inch size ones. The standard rabbit strips are eighth inch, the Magnums are a quarter. So what you can do is once you tie a couple of these, you kind of see, I think most of these particular flies that I tie, the rabbit strip I use is roughly about 3 to 4 inches long. So you can pre-cut all those and get them ready to go, set those aside. One of the biggest tips I can tell you is you probably, because the body of this fly has like a flat diamond braid on it. Flat diamond braid is a wonderful material to deal with, but if you get a larger fish on it, a larger trout with some teeth, gets a tooth or two caught in that stuff, it's going to shred it. So you're probably going to want to put some sort of resin or glue over that after you tie that flashy portion of the body. So what I'll typically do is I'll tie that portion of the body, and then I'll either coat it with, I used to coat it with epoxy, now I coat it with like a UV resin, like, clear cure goo or, you know, Deer Creek, any one of those ones out there, Bug Bond, there's a bunch of different companies that have it out there now. And that will make that body pretty bomb-proof. You don't have to worry about peeling apart. And like I said before, I really like flies that hold up more than anything.
Yeah.
That's probably one of the biggest tips I can give you on that guy.
Okay. And David Takawa in Yorba Linda, California, he says, Rich, I saw your video of you tying a cellar dweller. You mentioned fishing technique, but what type of line and how deep are you generally fishing this fly? I was thinking about using it in Southern California saltwater bays for spotted bass, using intermediate line in 8 to 20 feet of water. So why don't you use that as a lead to talk about how you fish this, and if you've ever tried it in the way that David's talking about.
Yeah, you absolutely could. I mean, I've tied this for people that have fished them in the salt, and they've used them in buckets for striped bass and stuff like that. So the method that he's talking about would definitely work. Like I said, I originally designed this pattern to be fished in some of the shallower water with a floating line setup. But when I say shallower, like, you know, in inches up to like 3 to 4 feet deep. So I would typically fish that as an upstream on a floating line. I like a weight forward style line. So it's got a heavy aggressive taper to it. It's going to help turn that fly over because it is weighted. And I use a leader that's anywhere from 9 feet on the long end to like shorter up to 4.5 feet. Straight mono, I like mono that doesn't stretch. You know, so usually like a hard, either a hard Mason mono, or one of the ones I really like is the Rio Hard Alloy. It's a saltwater mono. When I say zero stretch, it's stuff like piano wire, but it helps sink it. And then when you go to strip set on a fish, you're not pulling your arm out of its socket. I do fish this in the winter in freshwater in deeper runs, not to 20 feet, but up to 8 or 9 feet off the bottom. So the method that David's talking about for spotted bass in that deeper runs would definitely work. Have to use kind of like a countdown method. He could still use the same size leader that I was referring to, about 9 feet, even in a 20-foot depth. Most of those intermediate lines that they have now, usually they're relatively clear anyway, and it's going to sink as well, and that fly is going to plummet to the bottom. So I would probably be fishing that, and I'm assuming you'd be fishing that. If it was a river, I would be fishing upstream, but he's talking about a saltwater bay. Up into the gut of that bowl or that particular deep spot, and then let that thing get to the bottom. And then one of the best retrieves that I found with any kind of weighted fly is you accentuate a pause. So you strip it, pause, strip, pause, strip, pause. So you'll get that up and down vertical jigging style motion. That would probably be relatively effective for those type of fish.
Okay. And a question from Rick Takahashi, and maybe you can elaborate on some other methods. He asked, how do you like to set your rig for fishing streamers in both still waters and moving water? Is there any difference than what you've already described that would be helpful to him?
Pretty much the same setup. You know, I'm a river guy. I don't fish a lot of still water. I do very, very little still water fishing. The older I get, I did more as a kid. But this method that I just explained would definitely work in that particular setting for still water. But I don't really stray from what I do in fresh water, still water and moving water. I kind of use the same style of techniques. My leaders might change a little bit, but, you know, some of my streamers, like I said, if they're a neutrally buoyant streamer that doesn't have any weight in it, I'm going to fish that on a line that's got that sinks, whether it's an integrated sink tip or, you know, whatever. That's going to propel my fly into the zone. And then I've got my weighted flies that are, when I say weighted, those are the ones that are meant to be fished near the bottom. Those I'm going to fish on a weight forward floating line with a stout leader. And those, I try to typically, it's all about the movement of the fly. So if it's weighted, I want to have that up and down motion coming out of it. So like I said, I'm fishing it with a strip and a pause, et cetera. I don't like to make my leaders longer, but you could if you need to. If the water's deeper than 9 feet, your floating line's going to sink down too. So one tip I can tell you is, you know, try and fish a fly line where you has a brighter section near the tip of the fly line where usually a lot of your loops are built in, or you can actually put something on it with a marker, or you can even paint it with some of those UV paints they have out now so you can kind of see it. It works as an indicator. So if you're fishing a very deep section of water with a floating setup, if your line does anything, then just sink straight down. If it starts to dart to one side or go upriver or downriver or whatever, you probably got a fish on. So time to strip set, and you can use that as a visual cue. So that would probably be some of the best advice I could give you there.
Okay. We got a handful of questions here from the Internet to finish things up here.
Okay.
David in Washington, New Jersey, he was asking about weightless flies, sinking leaders, and he was asking about your typical leader setup with floating line. I think you've pretty much covered that. But he did have a second part here. He says there are a lot of good hooks on the market, and for the rear hook on many of your streamers, you use the Gamagatsu SP11-313H, I think it is. And he wants to know why.
I use it. That's a, to kind of give you an idea, that's a 3X long. It's actually an SP11-3L3H, so that means it's 3X long and 3 heavy. So it's a perfect bend, like Aberdeen style, so it's got a perfect bend. I like that particular hook for a couple of reasons. If you look at a lot of the articulated flies that I have, there's one thing that they all have in common. They have more mass at the head, and they're smaller near the rear. In order for me to do that, like a lot of the flies that I tie either have, and the two hooks I use the most for hook companies are Partridge and Gamakatsu. So the B10S would be the front hook, and the SP11, more often than not, is the rear hook. It's a lighter wire hook, number one, and it's got the perfect length, in my opinion, for a lot of the flies that I like to tie. So that lighter wire hook in the rear, especially on an articulated fly, because that's where you're going to get some of that kick and that motion coming out of it from the water and the hydrodynamics of the water going around the head of that particular fly. It's a lighter hook, so it's not going to dip down and sink as much. I use that a lot for trout because it's not a super heavy wire hook, so you get a little bit of better penetration if you do have a fish that bites near the tail. But it's more or less for the length. If I were to use a 4X or a 6X long hook for the rear, it's going to drastically change the proportions of that particular streamer. So there's a lot of thought that goes into how you design those, and that's primarily why I use that hook. Because anything other than that length is going to give me a fly that's not going to look right, if that makes sense.
Okay. And he asks another part of his question. He says, I followed your website long enough to know enough to when you were doing an enormous volume of orders every single week. What tips would you give to tie those large volumes as efficiently and as quickly as possible? And why don't
question.
You share your website address, too, so that everybody knows about your website.
Yeah, it's www.catchingshadows.com, all in one word. So I actually just recently updated my webpage, so I don't have – I had kind of a mix mash of a blog, which is still up there. At the other – it's the same address. You just add a dash in between the two words. So if you want to check either of the two out, I will tell you the old blog's not being updated, the new webpage is. And I do have a blog role on there. So it's kind of funny. It talks about the massive amounts of flies. It's all about time for me now. When I have the time, I do the orders for people, and when I don't, I kind of veer away from it. So my customers out there have been pretty great about it. But he brings up a great question. And if you're going to get into production tying or massive amounts of tying, whether it's yourself, shops, whatever, you've got to spend the time to – I mean, it's all about dollars per hour, to be quite honest with you, because otherwise you're not going to be making much money off this. You're not going to get rich being a fly tire. I'm going to tell you that right now. But you got to find ways to cut corners. And the best way to cut corners is prep time. So your preparation time of your materials is far more important than the tying sequence, in my opinion. So there's a lot of things you can do. I have forms built up that I use now that I borrowed from Drew Chacon. I witnessed those in one of his recent books he came out with, where basically I have these wooden and foam setups that every half inch have a slot in them. And I can basically stage out my materials for a pattern in successions of two dozen, if that makes sense. So we'll take this streamer, for example. And if I need, I'm doing two dozen of this particular pattern just for a number, I'll have 24 bundles of Marabou in this one stage. This other one will have 24 bundles of Flash. And I've gone through with that Marabou, and I've picked out all the usable stuff rather than sitting there and fiddling through an entire bag of this stuff for each fly. I've got all the materials I'm going to use set up ahead of time. That's huge. And it goes
You're
right down to...
You're using this device that you've got there as just to hold that, like it's like
yep.
a slot in it or something? That you just
yep, it has slots every half inch. So
yep.
like every half inch there's whatever Marabou plumes I have, or if it has Schlappen in the pattern, I have my Schlappen feathers in there. A lot of tires use them. My friend Mike Schmidt uses them. A few other guys do too. It's an ingenious way to do it. If you don't have that, it's something you can make yourself real quickly. You can kind of set
sure.
them out in piles on your table. But staging stuff is huge. So whether you're tying tiny dry flies up to giant articulated flies, the more prep time and the time you put into prepping the materials you're going to have and laying them out in the order of the sequence that you're going to use them in is huge too, because that's going to cut down on the amount of time you can tie that fly. And it's also, it's going to essentially make it so that, you know, you're less time fiddling around looking for things and more time getting the business done. And that is probably the best piece of advice I get you. And that goes right for every material, right down to your hooks, number, all the number of hooks you got out, boom, get those done. If you're doing an articulated fly, pre-cutting all your wire for the articulation point, getting your beads out, the whole nine yards. So staging your stuff is big. You have to get all those materials staged, all the stuff you're going to use, and then go from there. That's good. Probably the best piece of advice I could give you.
Okay. A couple more questions here. James in Alpine, Wyoming. He says, cold, clear, and low water conditions in western Wyoming. I have not had much success with streamers. What are your suggestions for increasing hookups?
It goes right back to what I was talking about before. Fishing a floating line setup with a weighted fly. You might have to go a little longer with your leader. It all depends. I usually like to keep it a little bit longer than the average depth. But, you know, if you're going to go out in low, clear water conditions, leave the sinking line at home and fish with a floating line and some sort of weighted fly. It's a heck of a lot more tactful, in my opinion, and stealthy. You're going to primarily be fishing those runs and rivers from a downstream position as opposed to being across or upstream, if that makes sense. So you're going to be downstream from the fish. Typically, they're facing upstream unless they're in a back eddy or whatever. So you can approach them from below, and you can actually make multiple casts with that particular setup through any given piece of water as opposed to basically your first cast is pretty much all you got with the sinking line. So leave the sinking line at home. Use a floating line setup and some sort of weighted fly. The next thing I will tell you, too, is if you've got those low types of conditions, then you're probably going to want to stick with fly colors, streamer colors that are earth tones or relatively close to the bottom of your stream. Reason being is, you know, some of those brighter colors might not be as effective. Those natural colors are probably going to be the most effective because the conditions are clear. The fish are going to be looking for something that's readily close to the colors of the natural bait in that particular river. And the bait, and I say, you know, the earth tones or the colors of the stream bottom is important because a lot of your bait fish and your bottom-dwelling bait fish, your crayfish, et cetera, are going to take on those colors of that stream bed. So those are the colors you're probably going to want to start out with, too. So those are probably the two biggest tips I could give you.
Okay. Phil in Kentucky says, are the streamers you tie based on an attempt to match bait fish in the waters you fish, or are the streamers impressionistic that focus on moving seductively in the water? Or I guess
more of it. A little bit of both, you know, but there's definitely, you know, if we talk about that whole predator-prey type thing, you know, you'll look at some of the flies that I have, they aren't exact matches of any type of bait fish, but they've got some attributes of a variety of different food forms, which I think is important. You know, I talked about it before, there's definitely time and place for having exact imitations when there's an abundance of a specific food form or forage in the water. You know, I talked about this before. Take the White River or the Delaware, you get an alewife kill or a shad kill, and those particular water rises and kicks all these shad and alewives into the river, and now they're readily, it's like kind of having a hatch. They're readily available food source. You're probably going to have something relatively close to what those particular fish are on the river, but for the most part, I like stuff that's suggestive. You know, it's more about the action of that fly, if anything, if that makes sense. It's kind of like Kelly Gallup talks about this a lot. If you want to be a really good streamer designer or a fisherman, start looking at some of the really good gear fishermen out there and some of the lures that are out there. A lot of those lures have specific motions and actions to them that are just deadly triggers to fish, and I think those are important with some of your streamers too. If you look at a lot of the streamers that are out there now, and there's a lot of different types. You know, one that readily comes to mind is there's two of them exactly. The Drunken Disorderly by Tommy Lynch. That fly, in effectiveness, is based on how that fly acts in the water, but it's also how you fish it in order for you to get it to respond that way. And that particular motion out of that fly is what triggers a response from fish, if that makes sense.
Makes a lot of sense, yeah. Well, we've run way over time. There's still some other questions coming in here, but I got to cut it off at some point. So
no worries.
Sorry if we can get your questions answered. You might hit Rich up at one of the shows or on his website, and maybe he can catch some of those that we missed. So we got to wrap things up here. we're going to take just a little break, and then when we return, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and we'll also be giving away a copy of Rich's book, Catching Shadows, and you can get all these patterns. I mean, we just hit three of them, and how many are in this book, Rich? Anyway,
I think there's 18 to 20, but there's multiple variations on a lot of them, so it's a packed book, to be quite honest with you.
Well, and the cool thing about it is he just doesn't give you the pattern, folks. He tells you the background and a lot of things like what we were talking about tonight, so you really understand what you're creating here, and I think that'll make you be able to fish them a lot better because of that. So check out his book. Anyway, Curtis, Headwater Books is providing a gift tonight of Catching Shadows, or the prize, I should say, to the winner. So stick with us and see if you can't win Rich's book here. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S. Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website at www.familyties.com. That's familyties.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on the link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away some prizes here. Let me fire up the database here, and we'll give away that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers first. And that's a great organization to be part of, folks. If you're not a member, please join. You can reach them at fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. And hold on a second. I got a little problem here. Okay. Get this database working right here. Okay. So the winners of the drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. And if you haven't registered for that yet, it's too late now, but do so the next time we have a show. That way you can have a chance to win one of these great prizes. Sorry, I'm futzing around with my computer here. Okay, here we go. All right. So the winner here of the membership to Federation of Fly Fishers is Bill Hefner in Pennsylvania. Bill Hefner. So congratulations, Bill. And after the show, I'll contact you by email and ask you for some information, and then we'll get your prize out to you. The second giveaway we're going to do here is for a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, courtesy of AmatoBooks.com. And another great publisher of both journals as well as books. And Dean Wormell, it looks like you won this. I don't know if you've already got a subscription to this. Dean, let me know, and we'll see if we can't get you something else. But anyway, Dean, congratulations on winning that subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. I say that because Dean has won quite a few prizes on our show, so I wouldn't be surprised if he's already getting that. Okay, now finally, let me make sure my queue is cleared here. James, you trying to answer the question before I answer it, maybe? That's why I clear the queue. Okay, so question to win Rich Strelis' book, Catching Shadows, courtesy of Headwaters Books, and you can go to headwaterbooks.com if you'd like to see more about their publications. You can also get Rich's book off Amazon, I would assume, or from Rich directly, so check out his website as well. Okay, so the question is, when we were talking about the woven mayfly, what was the trigger? Why did he design that fly the way he did? What was the trigger that Rich felt was getting the fish to take that fly? So Rich. Now we'll wait and see. This is a little bit tougher one to answer because it's not like a one or two word answer. So we'll see what they come up with. Well, Dean, I think you got it here. two colors with the lighter on the bottom. And I would say that's what I was looking for. Would you agree, Rich?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's the trigger. Dean, you're a double winner tonight. What can I say? And you will be very happy with this book. I know you will. So, Dean, again, send me your address in the question box there so that we can have Headwaters give you or send that book out to you directly. And that covers that. Thanks, everybody, for playing. I appreciate it. Hey, Rich, I really want to thank you for being on the show again. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank
you. Great for you to share your experiences and your knowledge with us. It's just wonderful. Hopefully you've all found the archive on our website. If you haven't, there are a couple of links to it on our homepage, links at the bottom of every page. And in the archive, you're going to find all of our past shows. This makes 230 of them, which you can search by keyword or keyword phrase, like trout, tarpon, Madison River, and so forth. So just use the search box there, look for what you're looking for, and you'll probably find it, and explore and have lots of fun with that. Our next broadcast will be on March 2nd, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. And on that show, I'm going to interview Jim Klug, and the topic for the show will be fly fishing Belize. Jim, a photographer, guide, and travel coordinator, is going to take us on a tour of Belize from the northern waters of Ambergris Key to pristine waters of Turnip Atoll all the way south to Hopkins, Placencia, and Punta Gorda. So join us to explore Belize. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Headwater Books, Front Range Anglers, Housatonic River Outfitters for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com. Make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.